Headliner Radio, the creative voice.
Hey, Richard Reed Parry, welcome to Headliner Radio. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm good. Thanks.
Brilliant. Where are you speaking to us from? So you in Canada?
No, I'm in New Orleans right now.
Oh, wonderful. How long have you been based there?
I'm not actually based here. I'm just recording down here right now.
Wonderful. But speaking of Arcade Fire, because I was going to say, it'd be wonderful to fully introduce you, but I'm sure you've spoken about getting into music as a younger person in the context of Arcade Fire many times. But it'd be great to talk about that in the context of how film and film music, do you have much recollection of that as a younger person? Did you ever have this dream of doing film scores before the whole Arcade Fire thing?
As a teenager, for sure. I remember, lots of different film scores making a various impacts on me when I was a kid, as they do, John Williams and things like that. And then Bernard Herrmann a little bit as I got into my teenage years. But I remember really distinctly coming home from the cinema after seeing Edward Scissorhands, the Danny Elfman score. Like just completely lodged itself in my heart as just one of the most kind of transcendent uses of music and film that I could have named at that time. And still kind of is. It's like one of the great scores to me, where like the music is given as much weight and as much space and as much of a lead role as any other part of the film, in that film. And that really impacted me as well. I just thought this was the most beautiful, beautiful thing. Just kind of emotionally really, really dynamic and really hit me and lodged in my heart in a way. And I remember just thinking, oh God, how do you do that? How could I do something like that? Mm. So that's kind of the earliest conscious memory of moving towards film music in some kind of professional, creative, artistic capacity.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel you have much of a, because people would obviously probably pigeonhole you as a rock musician, even though you're such a multi-instrumentalist and everything, but how much did classical music, not that classical music obviously doesn't necessarily have to be part of a film composer's repertoire, but do you feel you have much of a classical background?
I was brought up doing piano lessons, and I have a classical record, quasi-classical record out there in the world anyway. There's a Deutsche Grammophon record that I made called Music for Heart and Breath that's chamber music, kind of new neo-chamber music, I would say. Amongst other things, I'm pretty pretty broad spectrum in terms of my creative output.
No, for sure. And I often discuss this with film composers, how I feel like there's two main distinct ways of getting into film music. There's the sort of one way of doing it. So many composers go to work for Hans Zimmer at his massive studio, and it doesn't have to be Hans Zimmer's, of course, but that's the one where so many people go and end up becoming film composers after years of making coffee for a composer that works there and sort of learning under them, and they eventually get a shot at scoring a scene. And then there's, quite often directors want to seek out artists who may have never done a film score, but they're just fans of the music. Do you feel like you fit right into the latter category? Someone who's got such an artistic output, and do you feel like that's what you offer to directors in that sense?
I mean, I definitely did not have a tenure making coffee for Hans Zimmer. Yes, I would say so. I would say I clearly have a voice that comes from outside of the typical, anything typical in terms of film music. More from neoclassical and neo folk, and then rock music as well. And obviously, Arcade Fire did the soundtrack for Spike Jonze's film Her, and now I've got a handful of films under my own belt. So I think, I think film music is, and as it should be, kind of hungry for fresh voices. And I think there's just infinite amounts of pretty derivative work out there. So I think there's lots of directors that would like to be doing something distinct that, you know, takes a different path than, you know, capital F film music that kind of starts and ends as such. I think there's a lot of hunger for just genuine musical art being made out there, you know, and there's just so much stuff is done by rote that, you know, I think I kind of come into that category of someone who sort of came in the side door or the back door and comes with a different perspective and a different aesthetic and a different way of making music.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned her. How did you kind of divide up the that work between you scoring that as a group? And was it sort of choosing scenes you all felt drawn to? Or, yeah, how did you go about that?
No, it was like going through the whole film with the director, as you do. And we were friends with Spike from before that, and he was really, really excited about the idea of us doing it. And as I think directors often do, had one idea of what he thought he wanted, and then as you work towards trying to do that in the way that he's suggested, it inevitably kind of veers away from that and veers towards what the movie dictates. You know, I think the movie often has opinions of its own. And so often what you think is you want to try to do just doesn't work for whatever reason. And you just start to gravitate towards in the direction of whatever does work. And so, yeah, it was a very much like working on a song or an album. It's like the thing itself, the work itself kind of tells you as much what to do as anything. Kind of just worked on it as a band, and then in separate factions we all kind of also generated loads of little bits of music sort of alone in the studio, and started out with kind of a big pile of music and different ideas and ways things could go, and some of those things stuck and some of those did not, and then you kind of move forward based on what did stick and what worked, and then see what is missing and what the director's hoping for still. You know, if you've got, you kind of end up with this connect the dots pastiche. I mean, in the case of a movie like that, where it isn't one score and one set of instruments, it's sort of all over the place, and it's a little more song based and piece based, and each little bit kind of has its own personality and its own palette, rather than like one single set of instruments or ensemble.
And this is a very random spontaneous question, but was Sarah Neufeld involved much in that score? And the reason I ask is I'm watching this Italian Netflix show called Saburo, which quite heavily uses one of her songs as like a recurring theme, Where the Light Comes In, I believe it's called, from her second solo album. Yeah, and it just felt she seems like such an ideal artist to be doing scoring. So yeah, I was just wondering does she play much of a part in the her score at all?
Yeah, not like kind of as an ensemble member. We did a bunch of stuff with strings. Not too much in terms of showing up with music written or anything. But we did a bunch of spent a bunch of time doing kind of string ensemble days in the way that our band has always done so, with Owen and with Sarah and myself.
Before we fully dive into the scores you've done, particularly the Iron Claw, of course, I just wanted to quickly ask about your own solo artist works. I was just so interested in reading about how you've sought to kind of sync those releases up with solstices and equinoxes, and no, I was just so interested in how, would you say your music has a very strong connection with the natural world, and at least in their release schedules anyway?
I would say on a spiritual level, as well as in the as a release schedule. The natural world is a big thing for me. That project that you're talking about specifically is called Quiet River of Dust, which is a series of albums that is still in process. It started with two volumes of it, and there's another couple volumes on the way. And that music specifically is really about kind of the natural world and our place in it and our relationship to it, and going pretty deep down the rabbit hole of nature and all its magic and chaos and ins and outs. But then also, you know, Music for Heart and Breath, which is the first solo record that I put out that I mentioned already, that is obviously very intrinsically connected to nature in the sense that the whole thing is based on the human body rhythms. So the speed of the musician's heartbeats, the speed of the musician's breathing is what affects the tempos of the music. And everybody's playing along with these speeds of their bodies that are kind of outside of their own control, which is a really different, you know, kind of unique way to play music. So obviously that is, you could say, is very based in nature, although more like the interior world rather than the exterior world of nature.
No, so fascinating. On a sort of logistical level away from nature and heartbeats and everything, did that lead to any awkward conversations with record labels about, with you saying this has to come out for this spring equinox and the next volume's coming out for the solstice? Were they all very accommodating with that? Or wonderful.
No reason not to be.
No, that's fantastic. So on that topic, does that kind of lend itself to your film scoring? Do you try and stay in that mode of you know, think about the breath and all these wonderful things in your connection to nature? I'm assuming it doesn't feel separate in that sense at all, even if just because you happen to be working to a picture.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to start working on films not working to picture, and letting music go where music needs to go for its own sake. And I'll maybe watch a film once or even a few scenes, whatever they've got to show early on, if it's earlier on in the process. And even with a script, if they haven't shot yet, which has been the case a couple of times now where I've started before they've even shot the thing. And trying to find ideas and musical threads that connect to the ideas in the film and the kind of spiritual core of the thing, rather than just working to it visually, because I think there's you know if you're lucky enough to be, you know, to have enough time to do that there's always, you know, there's ways of connecting on really deeply to a film, to the core of and the kind of essence of the thing. And then there's ways that are a little more superficial, you know, it's kind of like if you can be involved early, you can sort of be involved in building the house rather than just sort of wallpapering it at the last minute, once the whole thing's already built. And that's definitely the way that I prefer to work. And the relationship I prefer to have with a film is where you can kind of get inside of, the DNA of the thing a little bit more, maybe plant musical ideas early on that they can use when they're shooting, even if it's only as a reference point. But like in the case of the Iron Claw, I was working on that. I knew I was going to be working on that way before they even started shooting. And so ended up writing this song that ended up being like the actors ended up performing the song live in the film, learning how to play it. So I ended up having to teach the actors how to play that song, and then that, you know, really wove itself into the fabric of the film, where it's like the, you know, the actors playing characters in the film are like have a band and in the film, and they're rehearsing it, and then the, you know, as one of the characters' life is sort of falling apart and headspace is falling apart, you kind of hear him playing that song to himself, and that's a really beautiful way for me to get inside of a project, of a score. That's obviously a specific case, but it's definitely my preferred way to work, is to really get inside of the thing and be a part of kind of building it in some way earlier on. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to ask about The Nest, because I did get to see that at the cinema. And I really enjoyed that film. I think it's such an important story. One of my takeaways was I wonder how many people actually saw themselves in Jude Law's character in that film. But yeah, I'd love to ask how you became involved in that particular project and how you related to that film on a personal level.
Yeah, I mean, I also think it's a really important film. It's like, and it's just so, it's sort of stunningly soft-spoken in a way that, in a way that is sort of rare in cinema. I think it's very universal. I think it speaks to the world in its current state and in the state that it's been in for quite a long time. You know, obviously speaks to sort of capitalism, you know, just kind of the most hideous sides of capitalism and where that comes from in terms of a person and psychology anyway, how I got involved with that film is actually that Sean Durkin, the director, was a fan of my Music for Heart and Breath album, and he got in touch saying that he'd written the whole film. Basically, the whole time he was writing the script, he said he just had that album on loop, and it was the whole spirit of the thing for him, the whole sound of that film and that story for him. And would I be interested when the time came in scoring the film? And this is well before he had shot. So once again, it was kind of this really beautiful way to be involved in something kind of early on, even though I wasn't doing anything. He was just listening to that record, but I knew that, you know, the mood of that record and that kind of feel, this kind of delicate chamber music that's sort of loose around the edges and a little dark but quite beautiful also, was the aesthetic that he was hoping to work within, and that suited me really well as a starting place. So that was basically it. Yeah.
Amazing. So were any of the songs from that album actually used as, say, temp tracks at all in the editing? Because I've heard some such horror stories about temp tracks and composers basically having to copy and paste whatever. I'm probably going to mention Hans Zimmer again.
Yeah,
gets pasted across. But yeah, was your music there already from the album you mentioned?
He had used some of it as kind of editing help, but he blessedly is not really a fan of temp music, and he really doesn't want. In both movies that I've done with him, his last two movies, he really didn't want me to hear how he had used the temp music for the most part. It was really just to help him edit and get a sense of where he was going. But he's really wonderfully focused on kind of artistic process and artistic journey, and doesn't like to feed you too many directives or too much information. And really sort of gave me, we discussed possibilities for ensemble size and for which instruments maybe we would be using. But then it was really kind of carte blanche from there, you know, and we discussed various conceptual approaches to the film. But yeah, thankfully he doesn't really like to lean on temp music, and he really doesn't like to be too didactic about what the music needs to do. And again, sort of lets the film decide what it needs and doesn't get too hung up on what it's going to need ahead of time, because the film really tells you, you know, the same way that, as I think when they're editing films, the edit really tells you how it needs to be edited, you know, things work or they don't, and you just move the way that it works, and you keep doing that and you keep doing that, and eventually you get to the thing. And it's really the same for music in a lot of ways. And I'm just very thankful to get to work with a director like that repeatedly, who's so interested in the deeper process of the thing and sort of the unconscious processes of the thing and the discovery, you know, involved in making a film in the first place, let alone scoring it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm so excited to speak to you about The Iron Claw, which I saw not this week and the weekend prior to that when it came out in the UK. It was my first time seeing it. My girlfriend had seen it at a preview, so she was watching it. She was very, very happy to see it the second time with me. And it's very interesting going into a film like that when you know it's going to be so full of tragedy. And it's kind of the opposite of going to see like a Marvel film where you just know you're going to have your dopamine senses constantly triggered. Sorry, but yeah, I guess very obvious question, but in terms of becoming involved, that was just Sean wanting to work with you again on this film, I think goes without saying.
Yeah, I mean, we, like, before we even finished working on the Nest, we were talking about working on the next one together. And he was kind of like, next one's about wrestling, but I'd love you to do it if you're up for it. Mm. And I actually was a teenage wrestling fan as well. So I was very happy to hear that it was about wrestling. That seemed like a thrilling possibility for me and ended up being a very, very exciting film to work on.
Yeah. No, I was a fan as well. And I mean, when I was much younger, it just felt like this very silly, entertaining thing. But actually watching the film, you realize how physically demanding and, you know, the potential for injury is enormous. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Obviously people say, oh, it's fake, so don't worry about it. But yeah, it may be choreographed, but then yeah, people are really putting their bodies on the line. Yeah, but these sort of things coming into your, I mean, yeah, when you were finishing The Nest, were you already having quite big conversations about the film with Sean, or was it very early stages at that point?
He was writing it at that point because he was still making The Nest. So, so it wasn't that advanced, but yeah, then he, you know, took time writing that film, and he worked on other things. In the meantime, he did some directing for TV and yeah.
And of course, that's the ideal scenario to be in the film from the absolute get-go. So yeah, once it was written and everything, what were your early conversations about the film like? And were you personally, were you quite familiar with that? Because I didn't know this was, I was in the sort of watching it during The Rock and the Triple H era. I didn't know about that family at all and that story of tragedy. But is that something you were familiar with personally?
I knew about it. I didn't know about it as nearly as in depth as I do now. I knew about the family and was watching the last brother who died, Kerry, that I was like, he was fighting when I was having my wrestling phase as a young teenager. And I remember seeing him, the Texas Tornado, but I wasn't like steeped in it as a mythology of the family or anything like that.
Mm. Yeah. And again, did Sean have like his own notion of the music, or is it more a case of him completely entrusting you to react emotionally in whatever way it is personally for you through the music to the story in the film?
He knew that he wanted to use big drums was sort of the only directive that he had ahead of time. But that could have meant anything. And he'd been listening to all this sort of 70s rock, sort of dude rock, man rock of that time, you know, kind of playlists of that while he was writing it, trying to just really get into a specific spirit of the thing. So that was kind of the only reference point that I had. And he wasn't like, write a bunch of rock music, but he was just like, I'm hearing big drums. And so I started knocking out loads of rock ideas, kind of epic, more thinking about actual wrestling and action, and kind of, yeah, rock energy. And we ended up only really keeping one of those ideas in the film besides the song. And it became kind of clear that there was a certain amount of scoring of action in the ring that needed to happen, but it wasn't action. It was mostly not, it was, the music was sort of mostly pointing to something a little darker and a little sadder a lot of the time, where it was like more trying to connect to emotions of the players behind the scenes and in their lives, rather than just like the pure action of what's happening in the ring on the surface. Although it kind of starts there, with just this raw energy and kind of youthfulness and muscliness. And, but as the film goes on, you get into kind of just kind of darker, more raw feelings, musically. And he really likes to lean more into scoring emotional landscapes of characters rather than scoring action a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't like a decision beforehand. That's kind of a general sensibility that he has. And it's also something that, once again, the film kind of dictates for him, where he's like, there's too much, it feels like it's too much connected to the action of the thing. And what we actually need to focus on is what's, you know, the sadness inside of the character right now. And so a lot of the time I'd be trying to go one way and be trying to get more into the in the ring kind of feeling of things. And he'd be like, no, we need to just focus on Kevin's sadness, focus on Kevin's sadness. So, which is a really challenging thing to do. And it's a strange balance, or a difficult balance to try and strike, musically, to, you know, to get certain amounts of the action covered and connected to musically, but also connecting to deeper, less obvious things at the same time. So it was a very, very challenging film to score in terms of getting all of those feelings covered at the same time, and over the scope of the film, just figuring out what the pace of the whole thing is musically. And it's not a super music forward film a lot of the time. It's really uses a lot of silence as well, and just natural sounds. So finding the balance of all of that and weaving them all together into one thing that felt cohesive was very, very difficult, for sure.
Yeah, because in terms of it being such a sad story, and in fact the astonishing thing is there's even more tragedy in that family than the film, I'm assuming time constraints, etc.
Yes.
Made it not logistically possible to include all of the tragedy in that story. But I was just wondering, it got me thinking how some composers might, for no fault of their own, end up going a bit melodramatic to try and fit with that. But whereas I feel like you did such an amazing job of keeping the music grounded in the story. And especially, you mentioned the rock music, that never felt sort of bombastic or over the top, even though, wrestling is you could certainly describe it as that. But I'm assuming that was very important to you, to not go melodramatic and keep it grounded.
Yeah, I mean, there were moments where I tried to go a little more melodramatic, or just dramatic, not even melodramatic, but a little more pathos-y. There were bits where we got into conflict about what the approach was, and Sean is a minimalist and just will go to great lengths to exercise restraint. And so there were moments where it was, where there was friction, where I just feel desperately pulled to score action and what's happening in front of us. And he's like, no, we have to be thinking about what's happened previously, you know, in the memory of the character, or, focus on smaller things. And that's a tricky balance to strike together, but you figure it out. Eventually you go back and forth enough and it works itself out.
Yeah, absolutely. But besides the we briefly touched on the rock music, but could you just talk us through how you created the particular sound palette you created for the film, and how you felt that was going to reflect the story and everything?
Yeah. I knew from the get-go that I wanted to to go sort of brass heavy, dark brass heavy, French horn specifically, which is in large part just because of the story and the kind of spending your time in the arena with these like young titans and all these guys sort of fighting for glory. And so there's something quite kind of a fanfare for kings kind of thing, having something with a lot of horns in it, a lot of French horns specifically. But then it's also simultaneously sort of one of the loneliest sounding instruments, the most forlorn things when you hear it on its own or in a group. But then also pragmatically speaking, Pietro Amato, who produced the whole score and who recorded the whole score and who writes music with me and worked on all of this music with me, is really the other half of my brain kind of unsung hero of my compositional world. He's a French horn player also. And so working with French horn and upright bass and drums a lot of the time for all of the initial, all the initial music that was written was just on those instruments basically. And a few other brass instruments that Pietro can play. So pragmatically it just meant that it could just be the two of us in my studio playing and recording all the time on those instruments. And I'm someone who likes to work from the get-go. I like to record the music that I'm making. I'm less adept at scoring for other ensembles. I'm much more adept at writing myself into the music and sort of recording myself into the music and starting from there, at least. If we're going to add the whole string section, great, but let's have an actual bed of something that I've played or I've played a part of. It just is sort of the way that I like to work. And so that meant that we could really do the bulk of everything, written and recorded ourselves in my own studio, which is really satisfying. And then sort of bring in a handful of people for various musical jobs, and then bring in strings much later in the process, high strings, and do that as an add-on. And that was we kind of knew at a certain point. They started, Sean and Matt, that Matt Hannum, the director, or the editor, started to say, oh, I think maybe we need some strings and sort of strings and piano forward moments. And so that stuff came kind of later in the process. And really the whole starting place was kind of dark horns and drums and double basses.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is too abstract of a question, but obviously in the film, there's so much of it's about masculinity and not perhaps the characters are sort of advised by their father to not be too emotional and never to be seen crying. And even after everything Zac Efron's character goes through, you hear him saying, oh, sorry, you shouldn't have seen me crying. And is that something you were trying to speak to in the music at all?
Yeah, for sure. Kind of hold space for really delicate and kind of lonesome and sad feelings, I would say, in terms of playing to the sort of interior worlds of the characters, like I mentioned, and always kind of contrasting it with this sort of bombastic outer life that they're living, life in the ring and life on the road. And trying to make those things sort of harmonize together so that you have this ongoing feeling of this kind of lonesome, sad internal life that especially Zac Efron's character, but all of them, are living, and really counterbalance that against this sort of big, muscular, sort of glorious other world. That's the world they're the face they're putting on for the outside world, and what they're doing as their job, saddling up to go to work.
Yeah, and I guess this question hinges on where the score was at until the point where you saw footage. But I'm always fascinated to ask how the acting performances and the music feed into each other. I mean, yeah, we've mentioned Zac Efron, and I was just so deeply impressed by his performance in this film. And of course, Lily James and Harris Dickinson, Jeremy Allen White. Yeah, I mean, it's such an astonishing ensemble piece, isn't it? Yeah, I'm just so fascinated to ask how their performances as actors influences the music or feeds into the music, or however you see it working that way.
Yeah, I mean, insofar as you're trying to score, if you're trying to score to the interior worlds of the characters, which was often the case in the film, then obviously the performances of the actors feed into that very strongly. And, you know, just like such an excellent cast and good script, like all of those, you know, the more cohesive the story is, the more cohesive the actors are, the more of a real world it feels like. And so you can really feel when you're touching that musically and when you're finding something that really connects to the depth of the characters, so the depth of the acting and of the filmmaking at the same time, you know. And you watch those things evolve through the edit as the editing process is happening while you're also busy scoring. So obviously, yeah, all of that, it's all kind of a big swirling soup feeding into itself, I would say, through the whole process.
No, absolutely. And yeah, you touched on the recording. Yeah, I'd love to ask briefly about the sort of tech side of producing this, sort of crafting the sounds and producing some of the sounds. And I'm not sure if you work with many synths at all, and perhaps crafting the sounds of plugins and things like that, if you're interested to speak about that, of course.
No synths. Almost no synths. There's a Selena used in the song, and there's kind of a variation of the song that's in the more of the score. A couple, like sort of two-thirds of the way through the film, but that's sort of the only synth in the whole film. Otherwise, I like to try and work acoustically as much as possible with real instruments in the room. Mm-hmm. I guess, and there's like we use kind of like a, you know, like a chintzy, like fake strings for one of the kind of Saturday Night Main Event TV promo ad.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. But that was just like to do something stylized that actually seems like it would have been of the era, you know, happening in the 80s on TV, which is what they would have been using then as well. But yeah, generally I like to try and work as acoustically as possible with real physical sounds, real physical instruments. And so, yeah, as I mentioned already, this score is primarily French horn, upright bass, drums, and various percussion instruments, and piano. And then some other brass instruments, like flugelhorn and trumpet, and mellophone. And then there's strings and kind of guitar feedback, actually, quite a lot in this film.
Yeah.
A bunch of guitar feedback can be quite a marvelous instrument to use in place of a synth. And it has much more of a, there's something a little more tactile and a little less within your own control about using guitar feedback in tonal ways that I'm quite a big fan of, and just recording that and sculpting that rather than getting too lost in a world of synthesizers and keyboard mm-hmm. pads like this. I mean, loads of amazing stuff can be done with synthesizers also. It's nothing against it. I just, there's some kind of, when you're working also alone or with one person, there's a kind of a clarity that comes from using acoustic instruments that I really enjoy. It's just kind of a clearer starting place than the sort of infinite synthetic options of all of the keyboards and all of the plugins. But that movie also, because it's set kind of starting in the, well, it's like late 50s, early 60s, the opening sequence, and moves into the 70s. And so we're trying to use, and we're using like period some period sounds to a point, where, you know, using kind of natural, using plate reverb instead of plugins, and you know, recording using preamps that are 70s, 60s and 70s preamps and things like this, which you don't have to do, but is a fun thing to do, a nerdy thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah. With the guitar feedback, was that just a case of setting aside some dedicated time to really experiment with that and find the kind of sounds that would make it into the movie? I'm sure that that could be a whole rabbit hole you could go down and while away the hours doing that.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of just all part of the process, part of playing guitar and incorporating that into the film. It's not like I wouldn't call it a guitar forward score, but there's definitely a couple of key guitar moments. And yeah, it's the nice thing about feedback is it's just something that naturally occurs in the room, and you can kind of ride it. It's quite an explorative thing to play with. And yes, one could definitely easily go down a rabbit hole with it. And sometimes one does, but you can make quite beautiful, you know, just kind of discover these beautiful tonal things. And then you try for one thing and something else happens. So there's quite a lot of surprise involved, which I quite like when I'm making music.
No, wonderful. And you touched on the song Live That Way Forever, which you worked on with Little Scream. And what part of the process were you aware, or had you realized the film was going to finish with a song? I'm assuming Sean was very open to the idea as well. And how did that come together?
From the time that I presented the song to him, I think he was like really stoked about the song right away and was like, oh, we have to write this into the film in a real way. We have to make them play this, and this, we can really, you know, springboard off of this song. So it was sort of clear that it would probably be the credits song, because of the full version of it wasn't actually going to be played in the film. So there's kind of variations of it in the film, and there's live version of it being played by the youngest brother in his rehearsal and at a party. And then as his mental health is declining. And so I think it was pretty clear from the get-go that this would be the credits song as well as kind of a single for the film.
No, of course. I mean, yeah, it's so poignant without going into spoilers too heavily. The youngest brother and his story of, well, he seems more inclined towards music than wrestling. And I think that's a very universal feeling for a lot of musicians wanting to do music and the people in their lives. wanting them. I don't know how much, I'm assuming you can relate to that a huge amount yourself. Or?
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
No, wonderful. Do you have any kind of a gentleman agreement with Sean regarding his next movie? Because you just seem to be on such a roll with these two films, of course.
Yeah, we haven't actually really talked about it. I think this film was extremely intense for him and for me. But he, having written it and then directed it, is obviously, it's such a long process from start to finish. And I don't actually know what he's working on right now, or what else he has been working on. I think this was the degree to which this consumed him, and sort of, you know, he was dragged behind it like a wild horse, I think was pretty real. And rightly so, such an epic endeavor, such an epic undertaking. So no, we haven't really talked about it, but we definitely really enjoy working together. I think he's a really brilliant, unique filmmaker. We will see. Yeah.
And yeah, here in the UK, it just seems the reaction to the film seems wonderful. The room I was in, there was certainly a lot of crying, and people came out clearly very deeply moved. And everyone I've spoken to, I was blown away by the movie. Yeah, how's the reaction been, you know, for the film and to the music, and especially on your side of the Atlantic in America and Canada? And I can only assume you're very happy with how people are receiving the film and the music.
Yeah, and seems great. People seem to, as you say, people seem to be really moved by it. Really seems like it lands for people in a way that I think is sort of stands out in the landscape of contemporary filmmaking. For something on this level, on this scale, I think it's great that, like, you know, because it's essentially a Greek tragedy, right? It's not a typical arc of a Hollywood film by any means, and that it's still in the cinemas right now and doing well and is just opening around the world in various countries, including the UK. You know, it opens in Japan soon. I think it's pretty beautiful, and a, you know, testament to what a solid and beautiful piece of filmmaking it is. It's real, you know, really feels like cinema, and feels like cinema that's worthy, really worth going to the theater to see. Yeah.
No, absolutely. Now, Eileen, that's not out in the UK. Yeah, I'd love to ask what I don't know how tricky territory this is for you, what you're allowed to say at this point, but yeah, what can you tell us about that? And yeah, I suppose how it compares to The Iron Claw. I'm assuming, having not seen the film, I can only assume it was quite a different project to work on.
It was a very different project to work on. Not sure why it is not out in the UK. I can't speak to any of those internal reasons because I don't know, because that's not my job. I wish it was out in the UK because it's a really excellent piece of film.
Yeah, it will be soon. Sorry, I should tack on in the next few weeks. I think it might be, you know, everything coming back to normal after the strikes and stuff. But yes, it's due out soon.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a really awesome film. Also, I think William Oldroyd is a really great director. And a very different process, but also kind of carte blanche. He was not very didactic about what he wanted. The only thing he knew that he wanted to experiment with was like using soprano saxophone and oboe as a starting place musically. And that was great for me to just have something that specific, but then there was kind of no instruction beyond that. I was like, okay, yeah, I can definitely run with that. It's a nice, nice initial framework. And yeah, I'd seen a few scenes of the film and I'd read the book, which I was a fan of. So I knew that I wanted to do it for that reason. It's such a strange, dark, cool, weird story. And yeah, and it's just like a really unique take. It's kind of the like noir, like femme fatale kind of genre, but updated and turned on its head a little bit, like I'm from the 60s, and like also filmed really beautifully. And yeah, he really gave me carte blanche to run with the thing. At a certain point in the process, he was like, I just rewatched Taxi Driver, and that's really got it. I was like, yeah, that is a very good reference point for anything. And that's such an amazing Bernard Herrmann score. And sort of speaks, there's kind of a parallel to this film in terms of the main character being sort of someone who's sort of repressed on certain levels and then is in some sort of process of being beat down by the world around her or the people around her. And so there's some level of kind of, William would say, we use the term bottled rage. It's like, okay, are we getting all the bottled rage that we need? So kind of trying to find some musical ground that was tense and feeling like it was carrying a lot of sort of interior weight and some mystery, because it is kind of a very mysterious film and seems like it's heading one direction and then radically heads a different direction. No spoilers. But yeah, that was, it was really kind of a carte blanche with a couple of directives in terms of instrumentation, and this emotional world, trying to get into this, you know, capturing a bit of this oddball character in her interior and exterior worlds.
No, absolutely. No, I can't wait to see it. And well, Richard, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, just to finish, I'd love to hear about what's next up. Yeah, for example, how's the recording with Arcade Fire going? I don't know how much you're allowed to divulge on that. I don't know how much you're allowed to say without breaching any NDAs about upcoming films. And finally, yeah, how's that balancing? That's something I'm always curious to ask about, how, especially with your solo work as well as Arcade Fire and the films, yeah, how's that balancing out going for you?
It's a full cup, kind of an over full cup. Totally honest. But I'm passionate about everything that I do, so that is why I do it all. In terms of stuff that's upcoming, I scored a documentary. Well, it's like mostly documentary that's partially staged, I guess. New film that my wife co-wrote, actually. Directed by a really awesome documentary filmmaker named Shannon Walsh, that's premiering at South by Southwest in a few weeks. And I scored that in the autumn. So that is the latest thing that I have done that will be coming out soon. It's called Adrienne in the Castle. Mm-hmm. That's a really beautiful documentary about kind of grief and creativity and what happens when people lose the person that they have built their highly esoteric and unique life around. And yeah, really, really beautiful film. So I guess watch out for that. And Arcade Fire recording is moving along. It's just a thing that we do.
Yeah.
And we're doing it. There's not really that much to report. It's just just an ongoing process that we're in the midst of.
No, wonderful. Yeah, again, just to anyone listening, to make sure to see The Iron Claw while it's in the cinemas and theatres and wherever you're listening from. And yeah, the score is out. It's available to listen to everywhere, essentially, isn't it? I don't know if there's like a physical release at all. Or
there is, yeah. There's a vinyl coming shortly. Oh, that'll be really beautiful. Mm-hmm.
No, that's stunning. Richard, thank you. It's been wonderful to speak to you. So thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Right,
thank you. Have a great day and evening.
You too. Take care.
Thank you.
Headliner Radio, supporting the creative community.